Good morning, it's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we've got an action-packed show for you today. Going to catch you up on the latest and the greatest of the world of the automobile. Well, last weekend, they were racing at Indianapolis. Not the Indy 500, but the Brickyard 400. So we'll have some updates what happened there. Formula One was in Hungary last weekend, the Hungaroring. Big Motor Time Motorsports is actually on a break right now. IndyCar, NASCAR, and Formula One are all off this weekend. Got some great articles out of the pages of Old Car Weekly. Catch you up on that. Got a very interesting story about some police folk and what they're doing to try to catch people on their phones driving in New Jersey. Of course, we'll talk about gas prices. Up a little, feels like. And of course, it would be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the car show. We're going to get in the Wayback Machine, and we're going to talk about a vehicle that was around when I was a young person, and it's called Coronet Carrier, an unrestored 1970 Coronet 440 station wagon. Well, within the Mopar community, Richard Myers is known as collecting rare, unrestored automobiles, motivated by the loss of one of his close friends, who established the Manny Collection located in Ontario, Canada. Well, in 2011, he bought this unrestored 1970 Dodge Coronet 440 station wagon that wears its dark green paint, tanned vinyl interior, matching numbers, 318 cubic inch V8, factory air conditioning, and the car was originally purchased by the seller's mother in Alabama, and it's been stored on blocks for years before Myers acquired it. Now, Myers, who particularly enjoys the hunt in locating these rare and unrestored Mopars, the original 1970 Dodge Coronet 440 station wagon perfectly describes his interest. He described it as price-friendly for being authentic, original, and rare. The station wagon is one of 15,066 midsize Chrysler Corporation B-body Coronet station wagons built for the 1970 model year, of which 7,736 were Coronet 440 station wagons. Even fewer were built with the top Coronet 500 trim level, and that was 3,436. Their base Coronet deluxe trim at 3,694. The Dodge 1970 Coronet station wagons would have been compared to General Motors A-body size, which would have been the Chevelle, which sold 40,000 station wagons in 1970. The Pontiac Le Mans wagons, which sold about 4,000 fewer than the midsize wagons of Dodge in 1970. No matter how you slice it, Dodge Coronet wagon is a rare station wagon. Like the competitors in midsize field, the 1970 Coronet wagon shared styling foundations with its more popular muscle car counterparts, in this situation the Coronet RT and the Super V, which I always loved as a kid. Now, the Coronet station wagon had a muscular V8 engine up to 334 horsepower, 4-barrel with a 383 engine could be provided. That would have been the standard engine in the Super V, the high-performance car. However, most Coronet wagons came equipped with a 318 V8, which is what was found in Myers cars, and a 2-barrel in that situation. Some Coronet station wagons also came equipped with a 225 slant 6 engine. And boy, they would have had their work cut out hauling even the base-equipped wagon at 3,585 pounds. A 3-speed manual transmission was standard on the slant 6, and the 318 power Coronet wagons would fitted with the top flight automatic transmission, optional behind these two power plants. Meanwhile, the torque flight was required an option on the 2-barrel 383 V8 engine, and also you could get a 4-barrel carburation if you were indeed looking for that. Now, the dimensions on the 1970 Coronet station wagons was a wheelbase of 117 inches, overall length of 211 inches, with a width of 76 and a height of 54. 3-seat station wagons, the rearmost passengers had the least amount of headroom at 35 inches, which probably didn't bother the children, likely sequestered in the way, way back, or the far back position. Front seat and second row passengers had similar headroom, 39 inches, respectively. Spanning 7 generations, the Dodge Coronet wagon was introduced the Dodge Coronet itself was introduced in 1949, as Dodge's top-selling model later fell behind the base models between 55 and 59. The nameplate returned in 65 to 76 for Dodge midsize line, included the high-performance-oriented RT in 67 and the Super B in 68. Both featured the big block V8 and could be fitted with a 426 cubic inch Hemi as an option. Now, upon the reintroduction in 1965, the Coronet became a immediate-sized B-body with a 117-inch wheelbase, Dodge's best-selling vehicle with over 200,000 sales in its initial year. The second year returning, the Coronet got all its styling up cues through 67, was well-received, and continued to produce more than 200,000 cars in sales on an annual basis. In 1968, the Coronet, along with the Plymouth Belvedere and the Dodge Charger, which the Coronet shared a chassis with, was reshaped for a more of a Coke bottle shape. The front and rear of the Coronet design became a little more aggressive, and little change from 68 to 69, but in 1970, the Coronet received a modest update, which included new delta-shaped headlight designs, plus a major facelift on the rear end. The loops were split as a tag from the front of the hood, much like you would see on an Oldsmobile Cutlass. Although in 68 and 69, the Coronet body was aggressive, with a 1970 grille design up the attitude. Now, the base Coronet body types took its styling cues from the two-door hardtop, four-door sedan, and a six-passenger wagon. The Super B was the Coronet Deluxe series, available in a two-door coupe and a hardtop configuration. The Coronet 440 lineup included a four-door sedan, a two-door hardtop, a coupe, and the six and even a nine-passenger van. Now, in addition to the federally mandated safety equipment, Coronet's deluxe models featured an all-vinyl bench seat, color-keyed floor mats, heater, and defroster. Of course, you had to have a cigarette lighter back in these days. 14-inch black wall tires, a 19-gallon fuel tank, self-adjusting drum brakes, the Coronet 500, an upgraded vinyl interior carpeting, and a sport steering wheel, 318 cubic inch V8, 20 safety enhancements. The Coronet 500 wagon had unique wood grain trim decorations on the body side panels and tailgate. Along most notable, those Coronets had front disc brakes and three-speed windshield wipers, cruise control, radio, power steering, power windows, air conditioning, high-impact colors such as Plum Crazy, Sublime, Banana, Go Mango, or Hemi Orange. And boy, I tell you, those colors were eye-popping back in those days. Options specific to the station wagons were luggage rack, power tailgate, standard on the three-seat wagon, and the tailgate window windshield wiper, and, of course, a rear compartment lock. Coronet wagons also featured two-way tailgates, which could be dropped to lay flat like a pickup truck, or could be swung open like a standard passenger-style door. Other options available on the 70 Coronet were committed to offering practical things, supreme fuel capacity, advanced safety features, and they were provided a truly memorable ownership experience, offering hot looks and strong acceleration. Whether the family was looking for strength, comfort, dependability, or style, Dodge delivered with this car. If they were looking for all this plus a flashy look, enhanced driving experience, yeah, Dodge would be the icing on the cake. Well, putting the fun in functionality, today the Dodge Coronet is primarily recognized for its high-performance RT and Super B models, which would become significant icons in the Mopar and American muscle car history. Yet the Coronet 440 wagon, seldom found in an unrestored condition, or in any condition practically, is likely to draw as much attention for its rarity thanks to the growing interest in station wagons. Many people realize the Coronet station wagon is a peeper-hauling version of their favorite tire-roasting muscle cars, and partly due to the fact that the Coronet wagon's scarcity, and partially because of its good looks. I mean, we've got the same front-end look as you do on the RT and the Super B. In time, Richard Meyer's 1970 Coronet station wagon, photographed for Old Car Weekly, was sold. Its new owner, Pierre Luzieri, a Mopar wagon collector from Northern Ohio, also shares his passion for these vehicles, so it's gone to a good home. Turns out that there are other rare Mopars out there in Manny's collection. Yeah, we're planning to use the funds from selling the 70 Coronet wagon to make some upgrades on a unique Plymouth Roadrunner that we recently acquired, so stay tuned for those updates. Yes, and looking at this car, the green color reminds me of the color of our 1970 Pontiac that we had, but the tan interior is just lovely. Everything matches in there. And to see this car that looks like on the front end, looks like that hot rod, but in the back, ready to haul a whole bunch of family to that picnic. The motorsports news, the headline reads, Dixon, Canaan, and Franchitti join Legacy Motor Club's strategic ownership group. Well, Legacy Motor Club has announced 9 new additions to its strategic ownership group on Thursday, which includes 3 former Indy Series champions. Scott Dixon, Tony Canaan, and Dara Franchitti have become household names for motorsports fans, combining their 11 IndyCar championships, 5 Indy 500 triumphs. However, expanding the group comprises recognizable individuals across athletic, entertainment, business, and media, and finance. Other people who have joined this group, Bryce Harper, 2-time MLB National League MVP and 8-time All-Star. Kelly Slater, 11-time World Champion Pro Surfer League. Andy Roddick, U.S. Open tennis winner. Sam Byrne, the co-founder of the Cross Harbor Capital Partners. Jen Rubio, an entrepreneur. And Chase Utley, MLB World Series winner and 6-time All-Star. So Legacy Motor Club also noted there's 30 champions through all these different awards, Grammys. The group also joins Darius Rucker and Guy Fieri, who are also a part of the strategic ownership group. This is not a traditional ownership group, Jimmy Johnson said, who is the owner of Legacy Motor Club. It's a collection of people who understand competition, leadership, innovation, storytelling, and how endearing organizations are built. They come from different worlds and share a common belief that legacy can become something fundamentally different within the motorsports culture. Great organizations are built by people who understand what it takes to win, but also what it takes to build. The caliber, diversity, perseverance of this group speaks directly to where Legacy Motor Company is headed. The Legacy Motor Club is also currently fielding 2 NASCAR series for John Hunter Nemechek and Aaron Jones, as well as a 3rd part-time entry for Jimmy Johnson, who is going to run the Daytona 500 next year. So that's pretty crazy. We've got baseball, surfers, and 3 former IndyCar champions now a part of an ownership group in NASCAR with Legacy Motor Club. Let's talk a little bit about last weekend in NASCAR, where Corey Heim, who is a part-time driver for the folks over at Joe Gibbs, wins the race. He pulls off a shocker. Well, Corey Heim stood on the front stretch at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, drained from the effort it took to win one of NASCAR's crown jewel races, the Brickyard 400. The race produced an unexpected winner and an unexpected millionaire. Heim held off Christopher Bell and Joey Logano over the final 34 laps to win Sunday's race, the 2nd win of his career in only 15 starts. So it was impressive. I watched the race, and I really thought that Christopher Bell and Joey Logano were going to be able to track this young man down, but they didn't, and it was pretty impressive. And then on the other hand, we have a new millionaire. Well, this was the final of the Cup Series in-season challenge. 25th seeded Todd Gilliland took advantage of 3rd place seeded Ryan Blaney's unfortunate wreck on lap 120 to win the $1 million winner take all by the last 2 people left to remain standing, finishing in 24th, with Blaney finishing in 26th. So for those of you who don't know about this, they put together a tournament, almost like an NCAA tournament, where you would take, you know, guys that were really good in the standings and guys that weren't as good, and they matched them up. And then they got to the last race, and they were racing for $1 million. And very cool that Gilliland ended up winning this. He was definitely the underdog, but he barely won, and it was pretty impressive. So, as we call it, it was Heim time on Sunday with Corey Heim, part-time racer for Joe Gibbs Racing. He's going to be racing next year full-time, has won 2 races out of the 15 Cup starts. The only other driver to ever do that was a very legendary name, and that was A.J. Foyt. Well, to stay with NASCAR right now, the big talk last week was about the fact that Alex Bowman is going to be retiring, and next year is going to be his final season. And he's been in the conversation for several years. Is he going to be staying at Hendrick's Motorsports? And he has had definitely some health issues. And their headline reads, Bowman says health reasons not the driving force in scheduled retirement. The day after announcing his plans, Alex Bowman reiterated that his health was not the main reason for choosing to retire. Bowman, 33, instead, is ready to do other things in his life, and he's ready to, in other words, be a normal person. I don't think physical health is the number one contributor here in this situation for me, he said at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway ahead of the Brickyard 400. Obviously, I've had my fair share of injuries, but I feel still like I can do this. I think although we figured out through the course of the season, everybody helping me at the Athletic Center with the PT, working on that every day. I think I'm in a pretty good spot. I can continue this. For me, it's much other things that I want to do outside the race car, other goals I have in my life and stuff I want to do. If it was straight up, I can't do this anymore, it probably would have been this year. But I feel like I can do this at a high level, and hopefully we can prove that. So he signed a one-year extension to his contract. So this is now going to be the biggest seat that's going to be available in NASCAR in 2028. So Bowman's going to drive next year, 2027. And then in 2028, that seat will be open. The number 48 seat, the seat that was made famous by Jimmy Johnson, Mr. Seven-time champion. And the buzz around the paddock right now is that Connor Zilich, who is racing for Trackhouse Racing, is having a very difficult year this year in his first year in Cup. But also, too, people know that he is an incredible talent and should not have any problem getting over this. His contract right now is up at the end of 27. So the timing looks pretty good for him to potentially move over to Hendrick Motorsports. Not sure that's exactly what's going to happen, but that's what we're talking about during these times where people are speculating who's going to get the ride when Alex Bowman vacates this car in 2028. Weekend Formula One was in Hungary at Budapest in the Hungaroring, and Lando Norris started from the pole and won the race. Max Verstappen finished in second. Kimi Antonelli, who is leading the championship, finished in third. Charles Leclerc in fourth. And Lewis Hamilton finished in fifth because of a 5-second penalty for speeding in the pit lane. The biggest story probably was the fact that Oscar Piastri had a very fast car and ended up having gearbox trouble. Looked like he had a chance to catch Lando Norris, his teammate, but the gearbox failed and he finished in, second to last, not even classified. He would have been considered in 20th position. So we are now in the summer break for Formula One and a little time off for the drivers and give them a little chance to rest before they come back and race. They'll end up racing all the way into November. To the break in Formula One, let's talk about how the championship is looking. Right now, Kimi Antonelli, driving for Mercedes-Benz, is in the lead at 219 points. Lewis Hamilton, driving for Ferrari, is in second at 169. George Russell is driving for Mercedes at 160. Charles Leclerc at 138. He is driving for, he's driving for Ferrari. And Lando Norris in fifth for driving for McLaren. Max Verstappen in sixth, driving for Red Bull Racing. And in seventh, you have Oscar Piastri driving for McLaren. And eighth, Isaac Hazar driving for the folks over at Red Bull Racing. So it's still the rich get continue to get richer. The big teams are Mercedes-Benz, Ferrari. You also have the guys over at Red Bull Racing and certainly the guys at McLaren. So that's the top ones, and then we'll be back in a couple weeks, actually 3 weeks, for the next race. And hopefully we will have some. We're going to finish the season strong and see if Lewis Hamilton can track down Kimi Antonelli, or can his teammate George Russell track down his teammate at Mercedes-Benz. Well, from the pages of The Drive, the headline reads, Mercedes-Benz CEO admits it forgot a little bit about the customer when it axed all the buttons. Well, according to this Mercedes-Benz CEO, a few months ago, one of the folks over at The Drive tested a new all-electric Mercedes-Benz CLA. Well, there were some aspects of the little sedan that were pretty much impressed me, but the infotainment system and a lack of common sense buttons and physical controls drove me to my wit's end. Now, I'm not saying I'm the only one, as Mercedes-Benz CEO recently went on the record saying that the automaker has heard the public sentiment and since realized that they maybe have overdone things with its button-busting campaign. Quote, sometimes you get a little ahead of yourself and do technology for the sake of technology, and maybe you forget a little bit about the consumer. So from now on, you will see us reintroduce most sensible buttons. Now, the chief executive also remarked that the industry as a whole might have gone a little bit too far with digital controls, including voice commands in response to questions of whether cars have reached their peak screen. Response says, I don't know if we're at peak screen, but I know we're at low button. Encouraging comments from him, a man leading the manufacturer that pushed perhaps more boldly than most toward physically replacing control knobs with screens. Of course, it's far from it's. They're not the only people guilty of this. BMW is right beside their old rival with the digital frustration department. Mercedes has also started to bring back buttons on steering wheels. As usual, it'll probably take a minute before we actually see this new philosophy bear out in its car lineup. But I have to respect the frankness of him and his designers and the engineers that they got a little bit lost in the sauce. So even if it was something that amazed most of us, the real world is usability, got its testing, and real world usability comes in first place. And I totally agree. Absolutely something that definitely needs, there definitely needs to be buttons in cars, not just push screens. Well, from the weird auto news section, cops imitating plants catch 72 people on their phones. Well, if you're driving through suburban New Jersey and you see a shrub holding a pair of binoculars, well, you're not really hallucinating. You're just not doing what you're supposed to be doing, paying attention to the road. Well, in a little town of Dunnville, they got extra creative. One officer dressed up in a sniper-style suit that stood next to a leafy green tree on one of the town's main streets, keeping an eye out for drivers who were holding their phones in their hands as a violation of a statewide ban in the state of New Jersey. Well, if you're getting busted by a cop dressed by a plant is not embarrassing enough. There's also a photo of a guy with a walkie-talkie wearing not a cop t-shirt. So you really have to be not paying attention to see this. Well, modern cars offer a lot of distractions and driver assists and things, but your phone is still the one that has the biggest opportunity to be a distraction. In 2022 study on rear-end collisions, they cited lack of enforcement of California's new anti-phone law and also vague words citing the reason for elevated rates of collision. Obviously, this has not been a deterrent. So these guys, well, we'll dress up as a plant and see if we can catch people talking on their phone. A lot of motorsports going on this weekend, as I mentioned, but there is some sports car racing. The IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Series Championship from Road America, and that is going to be today, and that's going to that's actually on the air right now, and that's on Peacock, but that also goes till 3 o'clock this afternoon. And then the Ferrari Challenge from Sonoma is going to be on tape delay, and you can catch that at about 5 o'clock, and that's going to be on CBS Sports Network, not CBS, but CBS Sports Network. Time to talk about gas prices. Right now, average gas price in the United States is $4.09 a gallon here in Arizona, $4.44. And I paid $4.39 at Costco yesterday and $4.99 for premium. All right, in New Mexico, $3.99 a gallon, $4.12 in Colorado, $4.25 in Utah, Nevada at $4.80, California, $5.65. As we head east, Texas, $3.59, Oklahoma, $3.71, and for our friends in Indiana, because that's where I grew up, $3.61 a gallon. All right, let's see what's going on around the state with our gas prices. Well, gas prices around the state from our friends over at Gas Buddy right now in Littlefield, Arizona, $3.56 at the TA Express. The Maverick station in that same Berg is at $3.66. Courtside Loves Travel Stop at $3.71. The Pilot in Courtside at $3.71. Circle K in Benson at $3.75. Eloy at $3.89 at the Express Fuels. The Pilot Station in Eloy at $3.89 as well. And sneaking into this, the Shell Station and 76 Station at 35th Avenue and Glendale at $3.89 a gallon. All right, let's look for some other inexpensive gas, or least expensive gas, I should say. And there are some places under $4 a gallon. $3.89 at the Sinclair Station at 16th and Bell, 16th Street and Bell. The Arco Station on 12th Avenue and Baseline at $3.89. Our friends out at Bucky's, $3.89 a gallon as well. Sam's Club in Avondale on Dysart at $3.98. The Costco in Avondale on McDowell at $3.99, and the Arco Station on Grand Avenue at $3.99 a gallon. We've reached that time, folks. Time for a little car talk. This is a pretty short question. Dear Car Talk, what can you tell me about buying out a lease on a car? And that's from Steve. Well, if you mean buying a car outright at the end of your lease, well, that's pretty easy. You simply get in touch with your leasing company, tell them that you want to buy the car, and the end of the lease price was preset when you originally leased the car and signed the documents. They send you the paperwork. You send them a check. They send you the title. You pay the taxes and you register it, and voila, it's your car. Now, if you mean buying out a lease before the leasing period is over, or basically getting out of your lease earlier, well, that's a little trickier. A lease is a legal contract, so you'll have to go back to the dealership, and they'll want everything that's owed to them over the life of the lease. And here's how that could work. So you leased an Accord last year, brand new price, $35,000. You agreed to pay $10,000 in monthly lease payments over the 3 years. So the buyout at the end of the lease was $25,000. You walk back in a year and a half into the lease, and what happens? Well, they can demand $25,000, the value that they were expecting at the end of the lease, plus $5,000 in lease payments that you haven't even made yet. And if you believe, they'll sell you the car for $27,000 right now, and then you're going to owe them $3,000 to get out of the lease. Well, at that point, you might as well keep the car, right? Since you're going to be paying for it anyway, it'll cost you more effectively and legally versus exiting or finding someone who will be willing to take over your lease. Now, you could know someone personally. You could also have a lease takeover site like Swap-a-Lease or Lease Buster that could help you match with a potential lease taker over. The leasing company would then have to approve the new lessee based off of their credit history, and they would lease transfer and a lease transfer fee, because of course there's always a fee. But paying someone $500 in fees is much likely cheaper than taking the car back to the dealer, and probably about the same as it would cost your cousin Vinny and what he would charge you to accidentally drive it into a cement wall. Good luck. Now, what we also didn't talk about is buying a car from a dealership that the car had been leased to someone else. So a low mileage car, off lease car, could potentially be a good deal and a good value. I would like the idea of a situation that would be a pre-inspected, also a certified car that just came off lease. It's been taken care of. It's had all its maintenance maybe done at the dealership, because during the lease time period, sometimes those are actually included in the price of the car. So that's absolutely something that you could or should consider. And I did read an article the other day that was talking about less and less people are leasing. Lease terms are much more stringent. You have to have much better credit to be able to qualify for a lease. And in fact, the pandemic really changed that whole ballgame with a lot of things going on in the automotive industry, and leasing was one of those as well. So lease cars are less right now. About 25% of the people who get a new car actually lease that car. Well, that's all the time we have for the Car Show today, folks. My name's Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back again on the radio next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.